This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com. This is Dummy.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler Magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler. Joining me from San Francisco this week, he is still the only member of this podcast to have scored a goal for Arsenal, and he's now a scout for the Gunners. Hey, Danny Carbassian.
How's it going, George?
I'm fine, thank you. Joining us from Bristol, England, not Connecticut, he's the author of The Ball is Round and Futsiball Nation. He has the hair of Kyle Beckerman, and David, are you wearing Argyle socks? He's probably wearing Argyle socks.
No, I'm not wearing Argyle socks. That's golfing attire.
Oh, well, you were supposed to be watching cricket today. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like something cricketers would wear, right?
Oh, dude, you need a big lesson in sartorial style in English sport.
Okay, today we are going to talk about those text messages between Malky Mackay and Ian Moody. Were they offensive? Yes. Were they private? Sort of. Does that part matter? No, not really. What matters is what the content of those text messages reveal about the rotten inner workings of many more soccer clubs than we would like to believe. Our own David Goldblatt published an excellent piece in The Guardian just yesterday about this, and we will also hear from London-based journalist Natasha Henry. Then we'll take a look at Major League Soccer's latest shady transfer allocation, of course, Jermaine Jones and how he ended up a New England revolutionary. Finally, Nick Pugliese joins us. He wrote an essay for the upcoming issue of Howler about being the first American to play professional soccer in Afghanistan. It's really fascinating. We're going to have him on to talk about that. So a lot of great stuff, but we have to start with Malky Mackay's dirty mouth. Okay, so we're joined here by Natasha Henry. She is a London-based sports journalist, and we have a lot of stuff to go through here. There are a lot of texts, a lot of gross stuff going on. But David, can you give us like sort of a Reader's Digest? Well, actually, that's probably not what we want. Could you give us an overview of what the whole scandal is about here?
Okay, so Malky Mackay was once manager of Cardiff City. He fell out with the owner Vincent Tan last season, in part over the treatment of his accomplice, Ian Moody, who was the chief scout, I think, at Cardiff. Malky Mackay was about to get a job at Crystal Palace as the new coach, where I believe Moody was already working. And at that point, into the public realm came a whole series of texts and emails and so on between Moody and Mackay during their time at Cardiff. And without giving any more airtime to the precise details of the messages, they're unambiguously homophobic, racist, sexist, and anti-Semitic. And these came into the public realm. Moody resigned from Crystal Palace. Obviously, Mackay is not getting his job at Crystal Palace, who remain without a coach. And then the extraordinary soap opera of apology or fake apology and dissimulation. The League Managers Association came out in support of Mackay, basically saying these are private messages. This is banter, friendly banter, but under conditions of pressure between these two guys. And then they were forced to apologize for the apology. And the apologies, they're always of the tone, if we have offended anyone, as if, there was any chance that people weren't going to be offended, like there was any ambiguity about it, that sort of needs to be the starting point. I mean, I don't know, I'm interested to know what Natasha thinks about this, but just to say, I'm slightly queasy about this because, you know, private messages for bigots, even, you know, privacy is important. And there's got to be a kind of public case for these things to be, you know, revealed. I mean, I think there is a strong one, but there's just a little concern about, you know, the leaking of these things, which probably wasn't really done with the, let's say, the most public of intentions.
Okay, so I think that's something we definitely have to talk about, how and why these became public. But first, I think these skeeved out pretty much everyone, except, I guess, Harry Redknapp, who said, he, you know, he's not like he's a rapist or anything, right? Is that really the discourse in English soccer, Natasha, where we have a coach come out in defense of another coach by saying it's not like he's a rapist?
You know, my mom says, like, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. And Harry should have just not said anything at all. I think Mark Hughes did a very sensible comment in that, you know, he understands that people in football have respected Malky for what he's done in the game, but what he's done is unacceptable. And he kind of left it at that, which was the best way to discuss it. Obviously, Harry Redknapp and Malky Mackay are friends. He felt he was supporting his friend. I think he was just making things a lot worse. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people with that view. As I said the other day, football over here is so undiverse. And Malky Mackay basically insulted everyone that doesn't look like him or doesn't come from the same culture or the same gender as him. The only person he didn't insult was British males between the age of 35 and 50, possibly. But the problem is, when you have a business, any business that isn't diverse, opinions like this and views like this are allowed to filter through and become commonplace because there's no one there to tell them what they're saying is wrong. You know, it's very hard for the FA or the LMA to tell him what he's saying is wrong. When you look around their offices and females, people of colour, anyone who doesn't look like them, there's very few people like that working there.
Well, yeah. So I'll amend what you said just by adding that he didn't offend British straight males between 35 and 50. And even then, I think we should all be offended by the things he said. You know, so I guess a couple of questions. You are obviously a female sports journalist. And I can't imagine, you know, there are so many different ways to enter this conversation. There's the people who work around and with these men. There's the fact that, you know, David, you brought up in your piece, the vast discrepancy between the players of color and coaches of color in the Premier League or English soccer in general.
It's just extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, you know, players of color make up of an English background 25% of the playing force. They're at least 25, probably 30% of the playing force in 30, total. Yeah. And, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, and given that that is absolutely the labor pool from which professional managers are drawn, that is the labor pool. You know, the numbers of black coaches in the league has been anywhere between 0 and 4% in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. I cannot see a better example of kind of institutional racism at work, because, you know, these are the people, they have all the skills, all the contacts, all the background knowledge and talent of their white counterparts, and they're not getting the chances because the people who make the decisions think, you don't look like you're not the norm.
I would disagree with you slightly, because talents and abilities all relative. There are a lot of Caucasian managers who I don't believe have the right talents and abilities to be managing at the level they are.
That's true.
But I do agree with you that, you know, it appears that, I mean, I'm a black female journalist, so I'm insulted on every level, but two particular levels that Malky Mackay felt to abuse people on. And it's okay for black players to play on the pitch and, you know, make clubs successful, but they don't trust black players or players of colour to run their clubs, to take on the mantle of the manager, which is really the most important job within the club, or even at a boardroom level or an administrative level. I know I go to the football and 9 times out of 10, I'm the only female in the press box. 9 times out of 10, I'm also the only person of colour in the press box. And I think it's a problem within football as a whole, not just football clubs. I think, you know, the LMA showed exactly the problems that we have. They have black managers. They represent all managers of football. Chris Powell, Chris Hughton, Paul Ince, John Barnes, but they felt it acceptable to say to a certain proportion of their members that you don't matter because the majority think it's all a joke, which is absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And there's another layer here, which is that Vincent Tan caught a lot of flack when he fired Mackay last year at Cardiff. You know, I think we all remember that. And Tan is himself sort of a character, you know, with the leather gloves and the high-waisted pants and whatnot. But, you know, so there are a couple things to talk about. One is how these things became public and why, because obviously Cardiff released them. And the other thing is that, you know, I think you're right, Natasha, the tone, the mood, the sort of the accepted practices of a club are set by the people at the top. And if there's no diversity at the top, then I don't think it should be a surprise necessarily. I mean, it's definitely shameful, but it's not necessarily a surprise that the culture creeps down and infects the club that way.
I mean, the text came out because there were alleged transfer issues or issues over transfer deals done by Malky Mackay and Ian Moody. So Vincent Tan and Cardiff City employed a law firm, very, very good sports law firm. And that's how they got their warrant to retrieve these text messages and emails. So in fairness to Vincent Tan, he was doing something to protect his own business. If he feels that somebody who no longer works for him has done some financial discrepancies, for want of a better word. And this is how the text came out. And then obviously Matt Lawton from the Daily Mail broke the story. I mean, part of me feels as if it's very convenient that it all comes out the day after Malky Mackay was due to be employed by Crystal Palace. But at the same point, I think let's not concentrate on Tan too much because he's not the issue. The issue is that a manager of a Premier League football club felt it acceptable to send those kinds of messages, whether they're private or public. His job is in the public forum, in the public domain. And really, fans pay his wages. Players work for him to be able to manage a football club. I think if we talk about Tan too much, then we're taking the attention away from the real issue, which is Malky Mackay's opinions and views, and the opinions of many in football, I hate to say.
You're totally right. David, you in your piece in The Guardian had a really, really moving sort of call for the public to sort of take back the game. And I kind of want to give you the last word and have you sort of, I don't know, I guess, echo what you said in the piece, because I thought it was really great.
I mean, I started, you know, and I agree with Natasha, you know, Vincent Tan is, I wouldn't trust him as far as I can throw him. And he's not really the issue here. The issue is how commonplace this is. And I think football coaches and those kind of the inner sanctums of football live under the illusion that they are in the private realm. But what makes them so rich and gives them so much status and such sort of extraordinary place in British society is that they are part of the public realm. Football in this country functions in so many different ways as part of the public realm, as soap opera, as theatre, as organised ritual, in so many different ways. And football is absolutely so delighted to take the plaudits when it contributes to the public realm. And the transformation of racist crowds in particular has been, you know, a source of great glory, reflected glory for the football industry. And they have to recognise that what has been considered, you know, a private realm is now very, very much part of the public realm. And then if we take this one stage further, you know, we recognize that football is a collectively produced product. It's not just made by the players and coaches. You know, it's made by crowds. It's made by all of us who kind of invest in the narratives and the stories and the joy that it generates. If this is truly a collectively produced common cultural good, the current kind of model of private economic ownership and the way in which money is distributed is totally out of kilter with that. And I mean, one of the things I've been writing about is to think about the many ways we might imagine socializing some elements of the football industry to bring it into line with that collective, collaborative, common product that it is.
So that reminds me of the piece that I just edited that you wrote for the next issue of Howler, which is about sort of ultras groups in Turkey, Egypt, Tunisia, Ukraine sort of taking their soccer organizations and making their voices heard in political arenas, which is really interesting. And I hope people will read in the next issue. But guys, I want to thank you, Natasha. I think that was a great contribution to the discussion. Thanks so much for joining us on Dummy.
Thanks for having me.
After turning into a household name during the World Cup, Jermaine Jones was suddenly a very hot commodity on the MLS transfer market, and he has just become a member of the New England Revolution. The mechanism used to send him to New England is new. They're calling it a blind draw. Now, there are certain teams that seem to favor a policy of blindness, of not actually seeing their transfer targets play soccer in their approach to new signings. I'm looking at you, Manchester United. But this is the first time we've ever heard the term used deliberately. Okay, so I imagine we should probably explain what a blind draw is. Danny, what do you know about this? I mean, you know, I guess we should talk about MLS allocation and how it's a little bit of a murky process in the first place, right?
Yeah, it is a murky process. This actually, you know, on a much smaller level, because Jermaine Jones is far bigger of a player than I ever was, but on a much smaller level, when I was coming back home from England and thinking about joining MLS before my knee just said no more. Paul Mariner, who was one of the guys that had sent me to Arsenal to begin with, was the assistant coach at New England. And he'd gotten in touch with me actually every summer during my time in England saying, you know, we'd love to have you at New England. We'd love to have you. And finally, when the opportunity came that it was a possibility for me to go back to New England, I learned quite quickly about the allocation process. So New England actually offered me a great salary and said, we'd love to bring you on for this. And my dad and my agent and I were all pretty excited about it. And then when we started speaking to MLS, they said, well, MLS wants to offer you this amount of money and you're actually not going to get to go to New England unless, you know, you're still around by the time their allocation slot comes up. So the rules are very murky. And as you said, like, this is the first time there's ever been a blind draw where one team looked set to sign him, and then another team entered the mix, and then he essentially had to promise to sign with MLS without knowing which team to go to. But the deal had to be sweetened a little bit, I understand, in order for New England to join the race, and eventually he signed there.
So, because he was talking to Chicago, right? And so
yes,
that was
exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you found out that, you know, even though you had a connection with New England, they were willing to pay you a pretty good salary. They couldn't sign you, and that opened the door for another team that maybe didn't even, you know, necessarily have plans to play you, but could use you as a bargaining chip or something like that, could just come in and get your rights and pay you less even than.
Yeah. Actually substantially less, which was not one of the reasons I stopped playing. I mean, at that point, my knee was completely finished. And oddly enough, like my knee was done, and I'd actually announced, you know, as we spoke last week about my heartfelt retirement letter to all my MySpace fans. But I'd actually already written that and essentially taken a job with Arsenal as a scout, and MLS came back to me and was like, hey, Danny, like or back to my agent and said, we've agreed on this contract, this figure for you. And my agent was like, well, first of all, we said no like 4 weeks ago, and by then Danny's retired and actually is already working for Arsenal.
Right. Okay. So David, this blind draw, we have a player who basically was told, okay, you're going to go to one of two teams. And I think that the thing that people find, you know, distressing about this is that there are very few rules about how these bigger players who return to Major League Soccer are distributed. We have Clint Dempsey going to Seattle, Michael Bradley going to Toronto, and now Jermaine Jones. Can you imagine a team in England sort of, you know, the English Premier League sort of banding together and signing a player and then saying, okay, well, you know, whether you go to, you know, the far north of England or Wales or London is sort of up to chance.
No, but this is to kind of imagine the Premier League is anything other than a small cartel for selling television rights. I mean, that institution is basically what it does. It doesn't do any other kind of regulation of transfer markets or really anything very much else. It lets its rich club owners get on with it. I mean, I think it is odd, and it's I just sort of think of the, you know, the athlete in this situation. You know, it's like it's your life and where you're going to live, and maybe you've got family, and who knows? And I think that's kind of, you know, that seems to me unfair. I mean, there's a balance to be struck. You know, MLS has a policy of trying to maintain a degree of competitive balance, which has been working pretty well for it so far, that model. And that means intervening in the transfer market. I mean, whether the kind of current regime is sensible for the next 10 years is another matter. But all I'd say is while you're complaining, remember there's a downside of having a league that doesn't regulate anything.
Right. No. And I should say, I'm not totally down on this. I think that, you know, from a player's perspective, obviously rules that limit salaries are a big bummer. From a league-wide perspective, and I think also you can make the case from a fan's perspective, some prudence in terms of spending is what allows us to have professional soccer in this country in the first place. So, you know, I think that balance, you're right, it's important. And I do understand why Major League Soccer would band together and do this. I mean, it makes a lot of financial sense. It's just, I think that where we're coming to is a junction where we're going to have to decide, okay, to join the biggest leagues in the world, you're going to have to spend like the biggest leagues in the world. And I think that balance is going to, it's going to throw that balance out of whack. We're going to figure out real quickly how and if we can compete in that market.
I think one of the good things about it, though, and over the past 2 years we've seen this, or over the past season, is more and more teams besides just LA and New York are getting top level designated players. I know we've seen designated players go to Chicago with Blanco in the past, and Seattle had Freddie Ljungberg for a little bit as well. But it's nice to see a really, not only just the U.S. national team players, but it's nice to see these designated players starting to filter in teams just apart from, you know, the typical New York and L.A., because for a while there it just seemed like the only players that the players that came over here only wanted to sign for those two teams.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, guys, let's leave it there. And when we come back, we will have our interview with Nick Pugliese, the first American to play soccer in Afghanistan as a professional athlete. Okay, so now we are joined by Nicholas Pugliese. I guess we just call you Nick, right, Nick?
That's all right, yes.
Nick has written a piece for the next issue of Howler about being the first, and so far, as far as I know, the only American professional soccer player in Afghanistan. Nick, you've had some publicity about this already. I know you were on ESPN. I believe there was a Guardian profile of you. Could you just give us a very brief overview of how you came to be the first American soccer player in Afghanistan?
Yes. Well, it was a bit of a circuitous route. It all started with a college friend of mine who, it turns out, his father works, or actually is the CEO of the leading telecom company in Kabul, in Afghanistan. And I, coming out of college, got an internship with that company, went over to Kabul, established myself, worked for the telecom company for 9 months. But in the course of that experience was playing for a company soccer team, and through my connections at the company team met a couple of coworkers who played for a professional team, and one thing led to another. They got me a tryout with Ferozi FC, and I eventually left the job to pursue the professional soccer gig full-time in Kabul.
So one thing that you write about is the fact that when you were playing, when you were still working for the company, playing on, I guess, Friday mornings or something like that was the only time you could get out and actually sort of meet other people?
That's right. We had very strict security restrictions surrounding what we were able to do as employees of this company. You know, like sort of no walking on the streets, only certain restaurants or venues that we could go to. But I carved out this Friday morning space where I could play soccer, you know, like I did back here in the States all through college in my childhood. So it was a very, you know, it became a sacred morning for me.
Yeah, and then you went totally local. You basically quit your job. You moved in with two guys who ended up being on the Afghanistan national team. And right here is where I'm going to stop, because I obviously edited your piece, and I know that David and Danny are listening to this. Probably thousands of questions are running through their minds. I want to open this up and let them sort of pepper you with whatever they got.
Nick, that just sounds incredible, man. I'm just intrigued to know if you can sketch for us What did it look like on a Friday morning? I mean, what kind of pitch are you playing on? Who's playing? Who shows up? How does it feel?
Yeah, so Friday morning, I'd hop in a van. I'd drive across the city to a pitch that was sort of wedged in the middle of a residential neighborhood. So it was a sort of pothole-heavy dirt road lined by mud houses with colorful iron cast gates and sort of children and parents walking down the street. It was Friday, the holy day, the day of prayer, so there wasn't too much traffic. And finally, through this sort of dusty residential area, came to an oasis of green turf, artificial turf. About 10 years ago, a family of entrepreneurs had started a for-rent soccer facility. They had a little futsal field, they had a full pitch, and they had dirt areas around the full pitch where kids could come and play pickup all the time. So the venue itself was actually pretty nice, you know, nets and the goals and a referee, you know, the standard standard characteristics that you'd find pretty much elsewhere in the world. And the teams were composed, the teams were mostly broken down by neighborhood or ethnicity. You know, I started playing with Ismaili Hazara teams, given that my company was affiliated with that sort of religious group. But, you know, over time, I got to mix with all sorts of different players from all over the city.
Okay, so now tell us about Ferozzi. One of the guys on that you played with got you a tryout with this professional team called Ferozzi. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So my friend who I talk about in my article, his name is Parvez. He's only 19 years old, and he plays on the U19 national team. And during the day, he was making about $200 a month sorting SIM registration information, so all your biographical information of someone who applies for a cell phone. But he was a fantastic player, and he also played for Ferozzi Football Club. So after one day, we had squared up in the midfield of one of these sort of low-key amateur Friday morning games. He says, you know, Nick, you're a good enough player. You should really be playing at a higher level. And sort of his own initiative, he went behind my back, although it was, you know, very welcome, and arranged a tryout with the coach of Ferozzi FC. And a couple weeks later, I came and practiced with the club for 2 weeks straight, at which point they assessed the situation, said, you know, we'd like to offer you a contract. And from that point forward, I was a member of Ferozzi.
That's amazing. And so I guess, Danny, I kind of want you to hear what the pregame ritual was for Ferozzi, because it's totally
different. Yeah, I'm actually
totally
interested. I mean, I actually have a couple questions myself, and one of those was going to be what was, you know, kind of a day-to-day and also a pregame ritual. But before you get to that, man, I just want to know, did you obviously, whenever any player usually, you know, signs for a team in another country, they do their best to integrate themselves in the culture and learn the language and everything. And I was wondering, to preface this, my dad's Iranian, and I've spoken Afghanis before, and, you know, we can communicate loosely through Farsi, but I was wondering if you – if they spoke Farsi there, and if you learned any Farsi or the local language.
Yes, so they do speak Farsi there. It's a bit of a different dialect than what they speak in Iran, but they consume a lot of Iranian pop culture, music, and movies. So I think Afghans can understand Iranians better than vice versa, but pretty much the same language. And I did get to learn it because you know, I learned it through necessity, first and foremost. After quitting my job, I moved in with two of my Ferozzi teammates. I was responsible for getting around the city as any local would, you know, taking taxis. I eventually invested in a bicycle, which was a ton of fun and a way to beat the gridlock on most days. And yeah, so I would call myself conversational at this point.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. I was going to say, that's a great point, though, because whenever I speak to Afghanis, I have a difficult time kind of really understanding them. I can pick out words here and there, but they seem to have no problem understanding what I'm saying.
That's right. So, yeah.
Another question I was just going to ask real quick, sorry, was what's the standard like? Because as I said, my dad grew up in Iran and always tells me, I don't know if he's just bragging about himself or bragging about that part of the world, but he says the standard there was, you know, incredible. And, you know, they don't obviously have – I suppose the opportunity that many of the more soccering nations of the world have for scouts, agents, and everything. But I was wondering, comparable to the U.S., having grown up and played here, what's the standard like there?
Yeah, I'd say that assessment of Iran is pretty accurate. I mean, Iran qualified for the World Cup, which was very exciting. The level in Afghanistan is a bit less than it is in Iran. So, I mean, I was a Division III player at Williams College, and I fit into the system with Frozy FC pretty well. It took me a couple months to work myself into a starting position at center midfield, and I felt the level was comparable to a competitive D3 program.
Cool.
The caveat here is I felt in terms of pure skill and athleticism, Afghanistan was at a very high level. But the coaching infrastructure and tactics and tactical awareness, fitness, nutrition, those things are still lagging behind even the D3 level, in the US.
That's very interesting. It's funny because I feel like at times in our country, we have too much organizational structure and not enough where the kids are just playing on their own, like, and learning the game, how it can be played. And some of these other countries, they struggle with the actual organization and the coaching and all the tactics and everything. But because they're on the field on their own every day with their friends, they develop technically and physically a little bit better.
So, okay.
Yeah, I think there's a happy medium. George.
No, go ahead.
To cut you off. Sorry. I just want to say, the national team, though, plays at a competitive D1 level, I would say, in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I mentioned in my article. There are two American-born players, Afghan-Americans, who play on the Afghanistan national team. And they both play Division I soccer in the U.S. And they're they play next to each other in the center midfield for the national team. One is Arash Hatifi from California, and the other is Muhammad Yusuf Mashriki from Queens, from Flushing, Queens.
That's awesome.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I guess so in the story, I'm gonna sort of condense this real quick, because in the story you talk about going to your coach's house, sitting around on the floor on carpets with your teammates and his family, bringing in big bowls of what is like goat stew and things like that for you guys to eat.
That's right.
Which is fantastic. And so I'm going to tease everyone and say you have to read the story to get more about that. But I do want to, I want you to tell us, like, what years were these, Nick? Because I think people are probably wondering, like, how were you able to be, like, cycling around Kabul safely as an American anytime in the last 20 years?
Well, yeah, I arrived in Afghanistan as part of my telecom company in the summer of 2012. In the spring of 2013, I joined Frozy FC, and I stayed there until December of 2013, so just this past Christmas.
So, like, what can you just really briefly tell us about the security situation? Like, how was that possible? Because the stories we hear in the U.S., and I assume, David, in England, are mostly of, bad, dangerous, violent things happening.
Yes. I think it's the bad, dangerous, violent things absolutely happen. It's a matter of selection bias in the media, because those are the newsworthy incidents and events. And what's less newsworthy but is very, very much prominent in Afghanistan, it seems almost silly saying this, is just the normal life, the normal tasks of daily living, the grocery shopping, the, going out and play it to the park to play with your friends. All that sort of stuff is still there. So, and furthermore, Kabul is one of the safest areas of Afghanistan. A lot of the fighting that we hear about happens in more rural areas of the country. So that provides a space for, the relative safety of Kabul provided a space for me to, play soccer and roam the city largely freely. I was circumspect about my movements, of course. But Kabul is a different animal than a lot of the other more rural parts of the country. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, great. Nick, thank you so much for joining us on Dummy. That was really fascinating. Okay, it's time for Tiki Taco, where we all bring up our favorite things from soccer culture or soccer news or whatever, or actually, now thinking about what mine is, you can't really classify it as either of those, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. Okay, David, what do you have this week?
Well, following on from our conversation about how much suffering do you want when choosing your team, my football experience of the week has been one of absence, and it's the dawning recognition that Bristol Rovers, the small club that that I support here in Bristol, which was relegated from the Football League into what is called the Conference, the no man's land of semi-professionalism, is no longer on the football highlight show, even for the three pathetic seconds that it used to get. And I no longer hear the name, usually a defeat or a draw, being read out in the on the radio at 5 o'clock on a Saturday. And it was the most, you know, I wanted to pretend that it didn't matter, but it was, I really, really missed it.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Good sympathy. I'm liking that.
Yeah. Danny, how about you? What do you have?
So, I don't know if many of you caught the opening of La Liga this weekend, but there was some incredible drama, which unfortunately turned sour for Athletic Bilbao. But so Malaga hosted, I guess Bilbao, yeah, in the first game of the season, and they were up a goal in the 95th minute. There was 6 minutes of added time. Malaga are down two men. They're up a goal, and Bilbao has a set piece. They whip a ball in, and Bilbao's goalie scores this header, like this incredible header, to equalize with, you know, like 50 seconds left or something. And it's, for some reason, mysteriously disallowed by the ref. Like, there's no, I'm not sure if they figured out why he blew the whistle, but there's no particular foul. It doesn't look like there's any offsides. But it's such an incredible header. And, you know, for a goalie who scores a goal, it never happens. So he's just scored this like remarkable equalizer, and he's just running off, buzzing, the whole team celebrating. And then there's this look when the ref points to the spot to say it's not allowed.
Oh my God. Okay. We will have a link to that in on the show page. Okay. Like I said, mine is a little weird this week. I'm going to just say a name and see if you guys recognize this name. Joseph Venglos.
But of course, one of the first foreign coaches in Britain at Aston Villa in the early 1990s, Celtic for a bit, no, and has a PhD.
Yes, as far as I can tell, the first. And I'm just going to read, David, I thought you would know who this guy was, but I'm just going to read this guy's resume off of Wikipedia. It's crazy. So yes, you're right. It is Dr. Joseph Venglos, born in 1936. He played for, and now you're going to help me with some of these names, David. He played for SK Slovan Bratislava. In the former Czechoslovakia. He played for the Czechoslovakian B team. And then in 1966, his coaching career started. In 66, he coached FC Prague Sydney. 66 to 67, New South Wales. So he's obviously in Australia now. 67 to 69, he's the coach of the Australian national team. 69 to 71, VSS Košice.
Yeah, Košice. Yeah, Košice. I think that's back in the Czech Republic, yeah. Or Czechoslovakia, as was.
Yeah, 70 to 72, Czechoslovakia under-23 team, 73 to 76, back at his old stomping grounds, Slovan Bratislava, 73 to 78, spends 5 years as an assistant coach for the Czechoslovakian national team, 78 to 82, he's the coach of Czechoslovakia. That includes the 1982 World Cup. Let's see, and also the 1980. European Championship. They got to the third place game. He's not even halfway finished yet. 83 to 84, he's the coach of Sporting Club in Portugal. 85 to 87, he is doing something with the Kuala Lumpur FA. I'm not sure what. 86 to 87, he's the head coach of Malaysia. 88 to 90, he's the head coach of Czechoslovakia. Again, I believe that includes the quarterfinal run in the 1990 World Cup. Let's see, where are we? 90 to 91, right. He becomes the first foreign manager in the Premier League with Aston Villa. 91 to 93, Fenerbahce. 93 to 95, Slovakia. 96 to 97, Oman. 98 to 99, Celtic. This is where I found out about him, because we're doing something on Celtic for the next issue. And then he ends his career in 2002 with JEF United Ichihara, which I'm just going to click on this.
That's in Japan,
right? That's in Japan. That's right. So, yes, that is a career. Man, so
we need him on the show.
We definitely need this guy on the show. I mean, that is an incredible career, right? I mean, I'm sorry. I guess I should back up. I bring this up because I'm just in awe. of the way that, you know, there are people in the soccer world who I had never heard of this guy, and I just can't imagine what his address book looks like. He just must know people in every country playing at all levels of the sport. I just love that. I think that's amazing. So anyway, that is Joseph Venglos. Hope you enjoyed that rundown. Okay. All right, guys.
Well, like, you know, you've got to love migration.
Guys, that brings us to the end of the show. I just want to thank you guys for joining us. I want to thank Natasha Henry and Nicholas Pugliese for being our special guests. Danny Carbassi and David Goldblatt are our regular contributors. Don't forget, Dummy is sponsored by Who Are Ya Designs. They've got a lot of great t-shirts, both European and MLS clubs. Go to whoareyadesigns.com and use the promo code Dummy at checkout. You get free shipping, and it really helps us make the show. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at What a Howler. And of course, issue 6 of Howler Magazine is coming up. So make sure you subscribe or make sure you renew your subscription. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They are members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight. They produced our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson with help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deffenbrock, and Melina Barajas. My name is George Qureshi. I'll be back with you next Tuesday with the rest of these dummies. Thanks for listening.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out whoareyadesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code Dummy at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at whoareyadesigns.com.